Hello, this is Dr. Lakin here, and I'm excited today to have with me my good friend, Dr. Howard Baum, who is a clinical professor at the University of Vanderbilt's endocrinology hormone department. And today we're going to talk a little bit about thyroid disease. Howard, thanks for joining. Appreciate that.
My pleasure.
It's good to be here visiting your state. I love this town. It's really a lot of fun.
Nashville's great.
And you're in the division of endocrinology. So tell me about, just briefly, if you could, just tell our listeners about your background and what you do now.
Well, I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, and I went to college at the University of Texas. And I attended medical school with the famous Dr. Lakin at Johns Hopkins. And after that, I stayed 3 more years at Hopkins to do internal medicine residency, and then went up to Boston to the Massachusetts General Hospital to learn endocrinology. And after I finished that, I stayed on as a faculty member for about 3 years at the Mass General, and then decided what I really preferred to do was to practice medicine. So I moved back to Texas, and I was in private practice endocrinology for 17 years. And then about a year ago, got an opportunity to move to Nashville, to Vanderbilt University, and work with a friend of mine here. So I'm still mostly practicing medicine, but back in a university setting.
Very good. Now, a question. Obviously, I mean, we know each other well, but I'm curious about what was it that attracted you to endocrinology? I'm interested.
I think that most doctors end up encountering some kernel of scientific knowledge or encounter a person that pushes them in a direction. And interestingly, in medical school, I was attracted to the subject, the sort of obscure subject of calcium metabolism and disorders of the calcium. And I found it interesting, so I took a rotation, a special specialty course in endocrinology in medical school, and I continued to find it appealing. And then in residency, I worked with the endocrinologists some more, and they were very nice to me and taught me a lot, and there it was. So it was really just sort of stumbling over something that seemed interesting and going with it.
Very good. And obviously, not everybody ends up seeing an endocrinologist. They do when they have specific issues. Mostly it's diabetes.
That's probably a good 50%+ of what I do. That's
okay.
Right.
And then I guess the other big one in my mind is thyroid.
And that's probably the second most common condition that endocrinologists are asked to see.
Okay. And I guess I'd like to talk to you a little bit about thyroid, because I think thyroid to me is one of those topics that it ends up being an issue that a lot of patients have concerns about. We certainly see it fairly commonly as an issue, particularly for women. And then there's a lot of sort of lore and perception out there that maybe differs from what the doctors might think about as far as, you know, expectations of treatment or symptoms and how it relates to their disease. So talk to me about how common is hypothyroidism would be the most common of the diseases.
So, right, hypothyroidism is common, and you're correct to say that it's more common in women than in men. So if you look at women over the age of 50, by the time women get 50 and above, about 10% of women will have hypothyroidism. So that's a lot of folks.
Wow. As far, you know, I see, you know, we do a lot of screening for hypothyroidism. What has a person come to see you specifically? I mean, obviously some people just get treated by their internist or family practice doctor.
So in hypothyroidism, that aspect of thyroid disease, there are a couple of reasons that I would see a patient. One is that the hypothyroidism is diagnosed by someone other than an internist or family doctor, say a specialist, a gastroenterologist, and they don't really feel comfortable taking on something outside of their area of expertise. And if the patient really doesn't have an identified primary doctor, they say, well, I'm going to send the patient to an endocrinologist. In the university setting, where we get a lot of referrals from distant places, a lot of times it's people with established hypothyroidism who have been treated by some other doctor, but they have some complicating factor or dissatisfaction with their treatment that makes them want to seek the additional opinion of a specialist.
And what are those? What are the things that people generally come in with that you talk to them about? What are their concerns primarily?
I think the most common thing that we deal with, and it's one of the most difficult, is the individual who has hypothyroidism, is on medicine for it. It appears that their blood tests show that their dose of medicine is appropriate, but they still don't feel well.
Yeah.
And so we have to try to determine to what extent their fatigue or their weight gain or their constipation is truly attributable to their thyroid condition versus that these are unrelated symptoms that are very common in the general population and actually have nothing to do with their thyroid condition.
And how do you do this? How do you figure it out? I'm curious.
Well, it's I think that for the most part, that once you have established that the thyroid blood levels are clearly normal and not intermittently abnormal, not in some way, quote, borderline, that I try to explain to the patient that all the information we have is that normalizing the levels is the best that we can do for them. And that that there really isn't any magic that I have beyond replacing their thyroid with an appropriate dose of medicine to normalize their levels. Now, I have to acknowledge that it is conceivable that there is some factor that we have failed to identify, that 10 years from now, thyroid factor X will be discovered, and we realize we've never replaced thyroid factor X when somebody has that missing. But at the current time, I don't have any other real tool. And so part of what I have to do sometimes is dissuade people from taking things, supplements, other approaches that might not really fix the problem, but maybe they've been convinced by their neighbors or the internet that they should be doing these sorts of things.
Well, you get at something that, you know, certainly is a vexing problem for primary care doctors too, which is, you know, the patient has normal looking numbers. And when we say normal, let's just talk about the different tests that people do, because I think that's one of the key things that people, you know, educate themselves about.
Sure.
And then they develop fairly strong opinions about these tests, which of course you and I've studied some, you've studied in much greater detail. And the different tests that we do are the TSH test, and the other two that I generally do are free T3 and free T4. So these are, can you just describe a little bit what they are, why we do them, and how accurate they are, and so forth and so on, just in a brief
Sure.
fashion.
So when the thyroid fails, the pituitary gland, which is sort of the master gland, wants to urge the thyroid to do better. So it will produce extra amounts of the hormone, thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH, to try to get the thyroid to improve its output of thyroid hormone. So it turns out that elevation in TSH is a very sensitive indicator of when the thyroid is failing and will start to rise even though the output of T4 may remain somewhat in the normal range. So the TSH is a pretty good test for hypothyroidism, and there's been a lot of discussion about what is a normal TSH. So you could argue that the upper end of normal of TSH is 3, the upper limit of normal of TSH is 4.5, and that's a very complicated discussion. But it's really difficult to show that you're going to have a problem or a symptom unless your TSH is over 10. So that individuals with TSHs of 5, 6, 7, which most people agree are, quote, abnormal, when you study such people carefully, it's very hard to show that they have fatigue or they have memory loss or these other kinds of subjective symptoms. So while it's reasonable to treat such individuals, arguing about very fine deviations of TSH is probably not going to be relevant, although, again, as you say, patients will come very adamant sometimes that these mild elevations are responsible for symptoms, and I think it's questionable whether that's true. I think for most patients, the free T4 probably becomes irrelevant because, except in very unique circumstances, the T4 is not going to be as sensitive a measure as the TSH.
And what about T3?
T3 has been an issue of some controversy because when people are hypothyroid, generally we replace the T4 or the thyroxine. We tended not to replace the T3. And even though this has been a big area of concern in patient-based websites that individuals should get T3, when this has been studied in large groups of people, many different studies, again, it's been hard to show that it really has not been demonstrated that T3 supplementation is helpful. So while we can have the discussion, if somebody's got a low T3, of giving them some modest T3 supplementation, I always express to the patient, I don't really have any proof that this will help you feel better. We can try it, but I'm not confident that this will help you feel better. And I think that some of the enthusiasm for T3 actually goes back to a study done many years ago in Lithuania by a Dr. Bunavicius, was published in a prestigious American journal, the New England Journal of Medicine, and suggested that T3 supplementation was helpful. Unfortunately, it was a very small early study, and a lot of subsequent larger, more well-done studies showed that the T3 was not helpful, but that initial entry into the medical literature really stuck and had some legs.
So there's a basis, or at least some potential basis. I guess the other thought I have is that, you know, people are having what we call placebo effect if you give them this supplement. Do you think that's part of what goes on?
Well, here's a perfect example of that. Some individuals with a very mild elevation in TSH will tell you, oh, I feel better having received the medicine, say even just plain T4 thyroxine. I feel better now that I'm on this medicine, and my TSH has come down from 6 or 7 down clearly into the normal range. But if you divide people into two groups and you give half the people a placebo and you give half the people a supplement when this mild TSH elevation is present, there really isn't any difference between the two groups. That the people who get the real medicine don't feel any better than the people who got the placebo. So I really think that there is sometimes an effect of taking the medicine. Is it possible that some individuals truly benefit, feel better subjectively from treatment of these mild TSH elevations in the 6 or 7 range? Absolutely, I think it's possible, so I have no objection to treating such people. But I'm always a little cautious not to promise too much that they're going to feel wonderful, because the studies really don't suggest that it's helpful.
So on that mark, I'd like to talk about just the two ways you can supplement thyroid. At least when I think of it, there are two ways. One is to use Synthroid or levothyroxine T4, which you mentioned before. The other would be to use some sort of combination. I mean, there are other ways to do it, but other combination like Armour thyroid, mm-hmm, or some natural thyroid. And what are the pros and cons in your mind about these two things? And how is it that we've come to think that T4, levothyroxine, Synthroid is the way to go, generally speaking? What's
so
the basis?
So I think that there, I would say that there are actually three ways to go. Thyroxine has been used because we have a very accurate way of dosing it. We have synthetic preparations that are at 75, 88, 100, 112, very narrowly measured levels of thyroxine. And that's 94% of what the thyroid makes is thyroxine. Turns out, oddly enough, that what the body actually uses is T3. But T4 to T3 conversion happens all over the body, so we figure if 94% of what the body makes is T4, doesn't it make sense to give people mainly that? So if we wanted to argue, though, that there is some relevance to that small amount of T3, that 6% of T3 that the thyroid makes, it's fair to add that as a supplement. But the ratio should be similar to what it would be in a normal person, about 17 to 1. So if you're going to give people a dose of T4, a very small fraction of their additional medication should be T3. So I prefer to do that synthetically, because if you use Armour thyroid, which is derived from pigs, just like Armour hot dogs, it's the same Armour, the 75% is T4 and 25% is T3. It's a big mismatch. So often you'll look at patients' thyroid blood levels on Armour and you'll see this big disconnect between where their T4 and T3 levels are, because it's so different from human physiology. The other thing is that because Armour is derived from animals, there is not necessarily dose precision from one batch to the next. So there might be a little variability next time you go to the pharmacy, the actual thyroid hormone content in the tablet versus the other. And frankly, the argument that something's natural doesn't necessarily hold much water, because I've never seen tablets in the forest. You know, there is some man-made handling of this. And the other thing is that poison mushrooms are natural. So something that's natural isn't inherently good. And I think you want to know not what is the origin, but what is the effect on the body. That's really the most important thing.
So you talked about then that third way, or the way of giving the thyroxine in very small increments, and that would be lyothyronine or
right,
cytamine.
Correct. For example, if somebody was on 125 micrograms, or let's say somebody's on 150 micrograms of levothyroxine, you could lower the dose to 125 and add 5 micrograms of cytomel or leothyronine, maintain that approximate Maybe I'm a little off with my math. Maybe it would be 12 and a half micrograms of leothyronine. And in that way, maintain that sort of 94:6 ratio as closely as you can. The problem with leothyronine or Cytomel, T3, is that the doses aren't as finely graded, and we really need a longer-acting preparation than we have. The leothyronine doesn't sort of last through the day quite as smoothly as thyroxine does. But Armour's one way of doing combination treatment, but sort of separating the two things out and titrating them or adjusting them independently, I think, makes more sense in terms of maintaining people's levels and health.
Okay. So now that we've determined that we're going to supplement somebody, we're going to determine that for most patients are going to abide by what we recommend to them, which is using the blood tests and, you know, adjusting basically according to trying to reach some normal parameters. Mm-hmm. But then there's the patient who basically insists and says, look, I feel better when I'm a little bit over-supplemented mm-hmm. or something like that. You're not happy, doctor, but I'm happier. So the question is, what arguments do you give to the patient, or what arguments do you think as a scientist and an expert in thyroid that you can say, well, these are the negatives that I want you to be aware of? You can choose to take these negatives, I suppose, or experience them. You may or may not experience them as physical symptoms, but what would be the things that you list?
Well, so the one thing is that I think it is possible that some people who are overtreated do feel better. And then you have to say, are things that make us feel better always justified? There might be individuals who feel better when they're using street drugs, but we wouldn't advocate it. But I think that I'm willing to tolerate some level of overtreatment as long as it's not excessive. So as you start to increase medicine, the TSH drops because the pituitary is saying, I don't want to stimulate anything anymore. There's already too much thyroid hormone around. So if the lower limit of TSH is around 0.35, if somebody's level is 0.2 or 0.18, really difficult to show that there's much of any problem, especially in people under the age of 50 or 60. But when you start to raise the thyroid levels and push the TSH down, in people over the age of 60, you start to worry about getting heart rhythm disturbances. So famously, George H.W. Bush, the senior, when he was in office, had hyperthyroidism, not because of treatment, but because his thyroid was overactive. The way it was discovered was he had a heart rhythm disturbance called atrial fibrillation that landed him in the hospital. So I don't want my patients over the age of 60 to land in the hospital with atrial fibrillation because I pushed their TSH to 0.02. The second thing is that bone density in menopausal women drops when you over-supplement with thyroid hormone down below 0.1 of a TSH. So I tell them that. The other thing is, if you look at people with mild hyperthyroidism, not necessarily those who have been given medicine to make them kind of hyperthyroid, but those who have mild hyperthyroidism, they die sooner. That if you look at risk of death in people with mild hyperthyroidism, it's higher than in those who have normal thyroid levels. So again, if you're pushing the TSH value below 0.1, it's conceivable now, that the person is going to die sooner.
How much is, I mean, is that a, I've never heard that statistic specifically. What kind of numbers are we talking
about? Well, I'm not sure. I would have to go back to, to go back to the literature. But what they do is these people who analyze large groups, they look at data from large populations and they realize that death risk is increased in people with these mild levels of hyperthyroidism. I can't quote you a percentage.
Okay.
Not like, you know, 1 in 2 is going to drop dead tomorrow.
Obviously,
but I think what it says is that there must be something not right about doing that. That mild hyperthyroidism is not good for you. And so I think we have to be careful. One of the frustrations that patients have, and I understand it, is, you know, doctor, all you're focused on is the numbers. You're not focused on me as a person. And I'm absolutely focused on the patient as a person. I want them to feel well, but I don't want them to have an untoward outcome that may not be immediately apparent. So I think that the numbers do mean something, because we are able to look at science and say, hey, when your number is this, this happens, just like cholesterol. If we waited to treat cholesterol when people feel bad, we would never treat anyone until after their heart attack. But we know that that cholesterol number means that your risk is increased, and we better get out in front of it rather than just waiting for something to happen. So if we know that that mild hyperthyroidism, whether from your own thyroid or from overtreatment, has some negative consequences, let's not just put that in the back of our minds and hope it works out. Let's be out in front of it.
Okay. So, look, Howard, I think this has been a very interesting discussion. You've added some things that I didn't know for sure about treating of hypothyroidism and some of the negatives of hyperthyroidism. Can you sort of summarize, maybe in a nutshell, just sort of your general recommendations and what you sort of the take-home message about thyroid treating underactive thyroid hypothyroidism?
Sure. First of all, I want to mention that all of the things I said are outside of the context of pregnancy, because that we could have another very long discussion about how to treat women in preconception and during pregnancy. But in an otherwise healthy person, I would say, number one, I tend to use thyroxine as my main treatment modality. I aim for a TSH in the normal range, but I do not have an objection to the TSH being slightly subnormal as long as it doesn't get down below 0.1. For individuals that really are convinced that thyroxine alone is not helping their symptoms and would like to entertain a trial of the addition of T3, I'm willing to undertake that. I lower their thyroxine dose, add an appropriate dose of T3 or levothyronine, and then see over a period of months, is this making a subjective difference and are we able to normalize their thyroid levels? And beyond that, I don't think there's much to it. I think that it's fairly straightforward, at least under current technology. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of folks have tried to make it more complicated than it is, because sometimes people have symptoms and we're too quick to want to make it their thyroid versus looking for other avenues that might help explain their symptoms better.
Very good. Howard, a great discussion, a great summary. I appreciate it. And we'll talk some more about other topics. Thanks very much, everybody, for being with us. Listen in for additional podcasts from Dr. Baum. He'll be joining us again for some other topics. Thanks.